Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands, the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney. And my producer today is Anthony Dockrell. Today, we have a one-on-one special with the boss of the number one online news website in the country. About 10 million Australians a month visit news.com.au. Sitting on top of it is Kate DeBrito. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm great. And thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
I hope so. We're going to talk about your own journey and some of the issues of the day later in the show, not least the proposed federal inquiries into media freedom. But first, tell us, what's the secret to news.com.au? You know, why is it number one?
Well, that's a secret, of course. I don't want to tell all my competitors.
Right.
No, there is some special sauce.
There is.
I guess I would say some fairly predictable things and say it's a team, but it is, because I've worked with different people at different times in my career, and I think we all know that there's a really first-grade team and then there's not. And I think that I'm fortunate at the moment that we have a really brilliant team. Some of them have been there for quite some time, so they know the brand really well. But I think that the other thing is that a lot of them have been in digital for a reasonable amount of time.
More than
2 years. They get it.
More than 6 months, they get digital.
They get it.
So just – but having the – so news.com.au, of course, is part of News Corp. So having the might and reach and – dare I say it, you know, some of the metaphorical love of the CEO of News, Michael Miller, and you know, various Murdochs, whatever, that must help, doesn't it?
Well, look, I mean, it's great being part of a big company like News Corp. You know, we are a huge media company, and at its heart, you know, News Corp has always been around about journalism and stories. News.com.au obviously had a bit of a strange beginning. It sort of cropped up on the sidelines, and quite some time ago, 21 years ago, it was a portal for many years. It was an aggregator, and it sort of morphed over that time into the news site it is today. There was a time, you know, years and years ago, where it ran content from the Daily Telegraph and, you know, the Herald Sun.
We saw a news aggregator. News Corp aggregator.
And then it has stopped doing that because the Metro mastheads obviously now are a subscriber sites, so their content's locked. So all our content is free, and I guess that's a great you know, it's a great benefit for us. It obviously puts us ahead. It's hard to be a subscriber only site and be the number one news site in Australia. So we don't take that for granted.
It wouldn't happen, would
exactly.
It?
No. So we don't take that for granted. Obviously, being free is our number one offering. But, you know, I think that those days of that sort of, you know, the fact of where do we fit in a company where they're trying to sell journalism as well have sort of settled a lot. The metros do their job. They do a great job. They're still running print operations as well as trying to drive, you know, subscriptions. And we, meanwhile, just dive in every day and give our readers the best of free content.
So when you're in the lift with the editor of the Telegraph or the Oz,
yes,
do they whisper, you know, oh, there's that...
Sweet nothings.
There's that free, you know, look how easy she has it. She doesn't know what it's like to be behind a paywall.
Well, no, I know the editors very well. I'm on an editorial board with them. You know, we work, you know, I hope very productively together on sort of some wider editorial guidelines for the company. So, you know, but I think the fact that they are now almost entirely locked and we are free sort of has made the division, you know, very clear to us now. We don't sort of overlap as maybe we did fumble into each other, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. I don't think that happens as much.
Sometimes you have similar content, right?
Of course, because the news is the news is the news.
Right.
And I think that that doesn't change. It's like you'll probably look around at 9.com.au or the ABC or SMH or the Daily Mail and you'll news.com.au or the Daily Telegraph and you'll see, wow, there's a lot of the same stories because that's what happens.
Sure. So how do you make news.com.au different?
I think we try to make it different by being really accessible. Again, I don't want to use buzzwords that mean nothing, but I do think that we've always been about the reader and the reader first, and I think we try to throw ourselves into the reader's minds and positions and hearts every single day. And, you know, I sit on the news desk. Lisa Muxworthy, the editor, sits next to me on the news desk, and we talk about stories all day.
Right.
You know, why is that? Why do they like this story? You know, we laugh about things. Why do they love this story? You know, what is it about this that gets to them? What's the entry point for them? You know, are they liking it because it's about, you know, we're talking about Trump's 4th of July.
The tanks. And
yeah, we're talking about what is it about that that's compelling? You know, I said my entry point was the tanks. It's interesting. Yeah. So we have to always find that unique selling point in a story, because otherwise, as we've talked about before, people just don't click. And if they don't click, why did you go to the effort of writing the story?
Well, that's right. If a journo falls in a forest, does anyone care?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Does anyone care if no one clicks?
No, they don't, and it's a sadness in digital news. Is you can go to a lot of effort, and if you can't make anyone click on that story, it's read by, you know, I mean, if it's read by a really tiny amount of people, then it does feel like a lot of effort for nothing. And sometimes it's a compelling story, so you really do have to work hard on the entry point, the way in, what's interesting, what's different, what makes this worthwhile. You can't just say a study today. I mean, the words "a study released today" is like the death of digital journalism. You need to find a selling point. And that's, I think, what some of our people do really well, that some of the page editors, some of the news editors, some of our top reporters can look at a story and know that you can't just go out and report something and come back and say, this is what happened today. You really have to find the sell.
So when you do, and you do, I guess, occasionally produce a story that no one clicks on,
yeah.
Is there a level of kind of, I know you don't have a lot of time, but do you kind of reflect on what went wrong?
Yeah, of course we do.
And what sort of things go wrong? What's the mistakes that the reporters make?
We can't spend a lot of time on every story wondering what went wrong. We tend to just learn our lessons and move on from them. And if someone kept making them, a reporter kept saying, oh, but this, we would, and those stories just failed and failed and failed, we would say stop doing them. Eventually, it's like this.
Go and work on The Australian.
Well, you know, there is a sort of attitude that, you know, our readers come to us for a certain type of story. They like our accessibility. We're unashamedly mainstream. We're a tabloid site in that sense. You know, we talk things up. We talk big. We talk, you know, emotions. We talk big events. So they come to us for that reason. I'm not saying we don't cover important stories. One of our stories, one of our reporters, Megan Palin, broke the story about the AFP, you know, officer who had killed himself, the fifth in a couple of years. She's been following that for years.
Number three or four on the website today, right?
She's done, and that story did really well. And we've been those, so it's not that we don't run serious stories or important stories by any means, but it is a matter of if you want to try and write something and you keep saying because it's important, but you can't find a way to bring that to the reader or make the reader think it's important, then eventually we have to say, maybe it's not important.
Maybe it's not important.
Maybe it's not important to them.
Tell us about the readers. So you use metrics. Every news editor, every editor has a, you know, an army of metrics at their disposal these days. But you use them. You're very overt about, you know, using them. You know, you talk about it.
Crazy for metrics.
What metrics do you pay attention to?
Well, we pay attention to the daily metrics, how we did in our daily UAs. So against our competitors, we look at what we did well at yesterday, what stories were the top stories.
UAs being unique audience,
Unique audience actually only comes out a few days later. There's a lag. You look at UBs, which we don't pay as much attention to these days because they come out the next day because the metric is essentially dead in market. It's not not something we pay attention to.
What about in real time?
Real time, we're looking at, we use a Chartbeat, which is our system, and we obviously look at real time metrics, what's people are coming to first on the page, but also how the story's doing. There's a number of ways of looking at and interpreting those minute by minute, and we use them all the time. So there will be times when I'll look and I'll say, I'll come back to my desk if I've been somewhere and I'll think, oh, look at that story down in Lifestyle. Why is it clicking four out of Lifestyle? And, you know, mostly people will say, you know, calm down, Bossy, which is what they call me. Calm down. It's been in tops and we've moved it down. Right. So it's still got momentum. So, but I think that's the conversations we're having all the time, is move things up, move things down, move things around, how they're going.
In almost real time.
Completely real time. Yeah. completely yeah. real time.
Do you think you would look at metrics in a different way, say, than, you know, Ben English at the telly or the, you know, the editor of the Courier Mail? I mean, is there
Ben's, you know, I would say about Ben is that Ben's probably a print editor with a great eye for digital. He came from the Gold Coast Bulletin, where he did a great job on sort of driving subs up there. So he definitely has a digital focus. But I guess a lot of editors, look, I won't speak for print editors. I know that they're all obviously got a huge objectives around digital these days, so they do pay a lot of attention to metrics, certainly much more than they did even a couple of years ago. But I think definitely for us it's a focus, and as I said, there's a lot of different metrics I look at. I might look at reports on a particular vertical. I might look at social reports. Well, I mean, I do look at social reports. I look at search reports. So I look at all sorts of different data to give me insight into what people are reading. That's really what it comes down to, is you look at the data to tell you. I mean, I'm a journo, so I'm not good at numbers. it's not about numbers.
That's why you're a journo.
You know, it's not about numbers. It's about insight.
Exactly.
And it does tell you a lot about what people are interested in. And that honestly is what I love about digital. And when I started in digital at news.com.au, I think that's when I fell in love with it, is because, and I described it to someone the other day, is there's a very thin layer between you and the audience all of a sudden. It's almost like you can touch them. And that's really, it's fun. If nothing else, it's enormous fun. Like the days when, you know, I don't have lots of meetings and I don't have to do all the boring parts of a senior job are the best times, because it's when you're just in the news and you're looking at what the readers are interested in, and you're serving them up more of it. They're giving you a round of applause and saying, yes, we love it.
Or
they're telling you they don't love it.
They don't, yeah. Do you ever serve something up that you know they're not going to love?
Oh.
But you think it's good for them, like, you know, it's basically eat your greens type stuff.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. We try all the time with things that we know, as I said, are issues that are very important. But again, we've probably gone to the effort. If we're going to go to the effort of doing something, not just a one-off, but if we're going to go to the effort of doing something, we will work hard on how we can make it work. We don't say just we must do this. Because again, if we can't make people interested in it, we haven't achieved our aim of alerting people to what the issue is. Like I talked about whales. I came in and I said, guys, the whales, Japan's, you know, back at it, 30 years, you know, they're back to commercial. It's like the first crack we had at it. Sunk, didn't do that well. Second go, we tried a few different ways into it, tried a few headlines, tried to change the picture, did all that sort of stuff. The second day, we tried again, we had a bit more success. So for me, we play a constant dance in that way. And that's something we'll come back to. I think that people have it's an issue that people feel emotional about for whatever reason. We need to find the right hook to make them, you know, engage with that and understand the gravity of that issue.
Yeah.
I think that's what we try to do, is we try to explain why this matters.
Yeah. Okay. You've said a few times, and recently I think I read a great interview with you in Mumbrella about saying that a lot of journos still don't understand digital. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think digital's got a bit of a bad rap, to be honest. I think that people have made assumptions about digital that aren't true. I think, you know, as I said, I think they've assumed that free digital is just aggregation. It's just, you know, that we're not doing real journalism. And, you know, I think that that's a bit heartbreaking for the people who are working in digital media who, you know, if I've worked in print, and if I could watch a young digital journo riding a computer during a breaking news event, like a big breaking news event, there's nothing you've seen like it. I mean, that's an ability to multitask, to pull information from all sources, to, yes, be on the phone. But being on the phone's not the only thing now. It's pulling from social. It's being able to grab photos, to know where to find them, to use online resources to get the information you need, to have multiple voices over your shoulder saying, when are you publishing, when are you publishing? I mean, it's masterful, and it's beautiful, and it's these, and I shouldn't say young people, because they're not all young in our newsroom.
No.
We've got some very senior people or older people in our newsroom, but they are very skilled and adept at it, and they're beautiful skills, and they're beautiful journalism skills. And I, as I said, I've worked in print, and I've seen some amazing journos that work in print, but there's something really, really clever about the way these people do their job.
Are we, in essence, talking about speed?
No, not just speed. I think you're talking about things that have always been part of journalism, about tactics, about ability to find the information you need to find. You know, and we all tell stories about the old journo who broke the phone in the phone booth so the next journo couldn't use it. And I think there's other tactics that journos use now, digital journos use. But, yes, it is speed. Speed's important. You can't do the job without being fast.
But it's smart and wily. It's fast and wily, isn't it, or something? What is it?
It is fast and wily. It's fast and wily, and it's never it's never lazy, because you can't, and I say this, I'm not implying that other journos in print or any other format are lazy, but there's an element of, I mean, having written for print, as I said, someone says, can you write about this study in obesity? You write about a study about obesity, it appears on the page. You can't, as I said, you can't do that. The digital journal has to go, what's my angle here that's going to get people into this story?
And it isn't, a new study shows that more people are fatter.
And people aren't going to care about that. They know people are fatter. There's no interest in them to read that story. You will need to find something else. And that can be hard. That's a skill in itself, is finding that way to sell it to the reader.
Okay. I suspect we might get back to this sort of stuff, but I want to talk about you for a second. And I mean this in the nicest possible way, but you are a bit of a veteran of this journalism, Mark. And right from the get-go, journalism was all around you, right? Your granddad, dad, mum, uncles, aunties, cousin, your husband.
Yep.
And, of course, your dear brother Sam, who was a Fairfax columnist whose death 4 years ago touched many people, including myself.
Yeah.
So was there any other option for you other than journalism? Did you think, oh, yeah, I could have been a pilot or something? I don't know.
I don't know. I think I did what a lot of teens did. I just stumbled through school thinking, oh, I'll think about it later. I actually didn't have any great ambitions to be a journalist. My whole family were a journalist, so I think I thought, oh, I'll never be a journalist. That would be stupid. But then I sort of rolled out of, my HSC. I don't know how clear a uni a degree looked, and I just think quite quickly the option presented itself. Someone said, why don't you try journalism? So there I rolled into a interview, probably had some friends who friends of the family who
it's a bit of a help, I guess, but
who said, interview this young girl. But I think from there you have to prove yourself. You become a copy girl.
Totally.
You do what you're told. You become a cadet, you hopefully stand out from the crowd, and that's the way it worked then. But it was great fun. I adored being a cadet journo and a young journo. The best, just the best career path, where you just wake up every day and you think, oh, my God, you get to talk to fascinating people, you get sent around to different events, and sometimes you're shit scared, but, And you've always got this crew back at the office, an amazing crew in journalism, as you know, and then you head to the pub.
Yeah. And is it like that still?
No.
No one goes to the pub anymore for a start.
No one goes, oh, no, they do go to the pub. They probably don't ask me all the time. No, we do go to the pub. It's not the same. It's not the same sort of culture. Workplaces have changed. Economies have changed, all that. There's not as many people around. People have to work harder when they are at work. There's less downtime, I think, than there used to be in journalism. Definitely less downtime. And I think that's a hard thing.
It's less fun, maybe.
Look, there probably is a little bit less fun. I think we still try to have fun at news.com.au. And I mean that. I think we laugh a lot. But maybe there's not the same sort of, there was always a lot of slacking off in journalism, which was one of its great pleasures, was that sitting around with your feet under the desk reading the papers was considered work. And it was for good reason. And for good reason, because you do need to read all of the papers to find out what everyone's writing and to be informed and to know how to ask the next best question.
And that's still true, right?
It's still absolutely true. So, it's definitely a changed industry, and that just is a matter of the times.
Yeah. You spent most of your time in the news fold, but you did break out and go off and edit Mamma Mia for a few years. And what was that like?
It was great.
Why did you do that? Was it?
Well, I actually left because I just wanted a little break. Sometimes I think you just go, what am I doing? And I just took a little break and thought, I've always, you know, thought next option will come up. And it did, because someone said, oh, you should come in and see us. After a month or so, when I was getting bored, or a couple of months, someone said, you should come and see us. And I went in and started, you know, in one position, and then Mia sort of made me editor-in-chief. So I really enjoyed it. I was only there a year, and I hate for that to sort of be any indication of me not enjoying it there. I just got a really great offer back to come back to News Corp as editor-in-chief of news.com.au. But I loved it, and Mia was always very generous with me. She's a very she's a fiercely creative person, so she sort of, they tumble out of her head at a rate of knots. So it was really interesting. It was good being part of a sort of smaller site for a while, where you've got a lot of flexibility to make changes very quickly.
And what did you learn? I mean, what did you learn about, I mean, because Mamma Mia, I mean, back then in particular, I mean, it's kind of part of the furniture now a little bit, and I mean that in the greatest respect, but back then it was very much on the edge, cutting edge of where the industry was going.
Well, I think they're doing a great job around podcasts, for example. I think what they're doing in podcasts is amazing. Look, I probably, in terms of where, you know, where the industry is going, I don't know if that's what I learned. I was surprised at how much I learned about feminism, which seems ridiculous because, you know, I've come from a feminist background, in the sense that, you know, I just never thought women couldn't do anything, that I thought of myself as a feminist. But there are lots of issues that sort of, because you're in that environment, that you sort of almost look at from a sort of a different perspective, or maybe you go a bit deeper. And
like,
I kind
let's give me an example, because that's
I think, well, an example that I didn't learn at Mamma Mia, but I think was something that came out of Me Too, for example, was the sense that, you know, as a woman, I've always thought, you know, I get it, you know, I get what women get, you know, spoken down to, and that women are harassed, and it was great when all of that was peeled back. But the second part of Me Too was the fact that lots of people who are marginalised also kind of put their hand up and said, oh, me too. And I realised that, despite the fact that I've always, you know, obviously thought in a very, you know, I've always thought that I've got a great humanitarian sort of understanding of people who might be more disadvantaged in life, I thought, can I swear?
Yeah, push kid. Swear away.
I thought, what the fuck do you know, Kay? Like, you're a white middle class woman. And I guess I'm not trying to sort of talk myself down, but, like, honestly, I think it dawned on me that, like, do you really understand the position of an Aboriginal woman in a domestic violence situation? Do you really understand what it's like for a disabled person, who's never been able to get a job in a, you know, I guess it just made me feel a little bit humble, that whole thing, because I thought, even when you think that you know and you can go, oh, no, I feel for those people, I think maybe you have to kind of realise you don't necessarily know. You don't know.
You've got to walk in the shoes then,
I think,
right?
At Mamma Mia, that was sort of some of the things that we would look at, is you'd look at an issue, but then you'd look at it again and you'd think, can I really speak to this? Mm. Do I really have a right to a voice? And me, I'd be like, oh, of course we do. We can speak about this. And I think the people there, and it wasn't always Mia, sometimes it's the young women who work there, would sort of, because they've got this sort of ethos, they would say, I don't know if you can speak to that. So I guess I learnt some lessons from younger women too, from a different generation who look at the world a little bit differently to me.
Mm. Cool. Let's talk a little bit about current events. Press freedom, very much a current event. In the wake of the raids on News Corp's Nika Smethurst and the ABC, we've seen this unprecedented, really, alliance of news organisations demanding action to ensure journos can do their job and whistleblowers can blow, if you like. And lo and behold, the government and the opposition seem to be listening, right? We now have this plans for not one but two federal inquiries into media freedom. So they are, politicians not only listening, they're also acting. What do you think? Where is this going to go and what needs to happen?
Well, you know, I hope that they do act to protect the freedom of the press. I think, unfortunately, sometimes in that messaging, I hope that it didn't get lost on the people, what we were trying to talk about. This wasn't about, you know, just the press saying we've got the right to do whatever we want. Sure. This is the fact that unless you have some protections around people who want to speak to the press, unless you can know that they're not going to be investigated or persecuted, or that the AFP is not going to come after you, that people will stop speaking out about injustices. They will stop speaking out about corruption because they'll know that they're not protected. I think these are sort of fundamental parts of the way the media operates. It's the fact that journos would rather go to jail than give up a source. You can't operate in an environment where you need to tell me something important because you have no other way of creating change than talking to a journalist. And yet you know that at the drop of the hat, your identity will be given up, your life could be ruined, you could be prosecuted yourself. I think it's an appalling state of affairs that those raids took place.
Oh, okay. So, Kate, what needs to happen? And maybe we can turn our attention a bit to that social media space as well about this.
Yeah, well, you know about the defamation payout or the defamation ruling the other day in terms of Facebook. So Nationwide News was found to have defamed Dylan Voller, who you famously remember sort of...
was incarcerated in Darwin and his treatment caused the Royal Commission.
Correct. So around that, we've got this sort of fairly crazy situation where Nationwide News has been held responsible for a Facebook post that they put up and a comment that was found to have defamed... defamed him. Now, look, the issue is with this is that the judge kind of didn't I don't know if he didn't really understand what was going on, because he sort of suggested that we could have turned off the comments.
Which you can't, right?
Can't turn off comments. Yeah. And it seems that the reporting about this has been really odd, even in trade media. I think because they're reading from the judgment. Right. And the judge assumed that you could turn off comments, so that, and because, you know, you were putting stuff up on Facebook in order to draw commentary or people to start talking about it, that you kind of, you knew what was going to happen. But the problem is, it means that any story you put up on Facebook, you can't turn the comments off. Facebook does not give publishers, doesn't give anyone the ability to pre-moderate. All you can do is post-moderate. But once a comment has been up, you've essentially potentially defamed someone right there and then. So you can add some filters. You can obviously add some keywords like pedophile or like dodgy, or you can add filters that can help mitigate that risk, but you can only moderate after publication, and you don't have the option of turning comments off. So it's actually a really significant ruling, and I'm not really sure where it's going to go at this point. I think that the best thing to do would be for Facebook to make a change so that publishers had a right to not turn comments on, because there's just no way. And it's not even just publishers. It's obviously, you know, big corporations who have Facebook pages. It's politicians who have Facebook pages. Anyone can jump on, can say something defamatory.
Well, it could be neighbours who say something about another neighbour. You can still, defame someone about a dispute about a fence.
I mean, but the crazy ruling from our perspective is that Facebook doesn't seem to be drawn into this at all, even though they're the ones pulling all the sort of the levers. They haven't been asked to take any responsibility for comments that are left on their platform. Publishers are seen as the publisher of the defamatory comment, even though they didn't write it. They published it. So, look, I'd be interested to see where that goes, but it is going to create some major headaches. And I don't know if nothing changes, I think publishers will need to make decisions about whether they post on Facebook at all.
Yeah, it's a great debate. And maybe the ACCC report, which coming out very soon, might also touch that off again. Talking about big stories of the week, Tom Gleeson won the Logies, basically for taking the piss out of the Logies, and then he got up and made a speech in which he even more took the piss out of the Logies. Was that a great news moment, or are we seeing the death of the Logies?
I think it was pretty good. I think the Logies must have known. I mean, his intro speech was just, you know, he just cut through the Logies so terribly. They must have known that was coming. So I think that they've obviously seen that it's controversial. It's going to create a bit of excitement. I mean,
good news for the Logies then.
Sorry?
Maybe it's good news for the Logies.
I think probably good news for the Logies. I mean, in some ways it's a bit sad. I sort of felt bad for people like Amanda Kelly. You kind of think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if you get a get some sort of reward for your years in the business. And it is a bit hard to see someone just taking the piss out of it like that. But look, I don't know him at all. I don't know him personally. I don't know whether he went at it with a sort of with a level of just humour, or whether there was a viciousness in it. I'm not sure. I think it was probably good for the Logie, so definitely a bit of excitement.
I guess so. Well, it certainly got everyone talking about the Logies again. I mean, in this kind of converged world we live in, where, you know, what you do on news.com is not dissimilar to what Seven does on its website and what have you. I mean, don't we need a new kind of, I mean, also a serious question really, is don't we need a way of recognizing them? I mean, the Logies seem to me a bit of an anachronism really these days, because who watches appointment TV?
Well, I know. And, you know, my kids watch YouTube, or they watch it on streaming services,
yeah,
or Foxtel. You know, they're not watching – they actually never turn on appointment TV, free-to-air TV.
No,
they're not sitting
mine
down,
are the same. Exactly.
They're
the
not
same.
Sitting down to watch The Voice even. So, I'm not sure what the future of that is. I know that's still obviously got a huge market, but it's got to be dwindling.
Well, maybe we need a sort of a Logies or a Walkleys that looks at or rewards the kind of, you know, achievements that news.com. I am pissing in your pocket, but
I've talked to the Walkleys about that.
Yeah. Well, there should be one that looks at categories that looks at clicks, shares, and engagements,
right? Well, I think what the Walkleys, when we had a conversation about it, and I sort of said, you know, we do so many things that are important, I think, in news, and, you know, what we do has value, but they'll come back and they'll say these are awards for journalism. And I say, but I understand that, but it's not all journalism is 3 months spent in the NT, you know, looking at vanishing dot paintings. Like, right. I understand that's a worthwhile story and probably does deserve a Walkley, but not every journalist can do that. So I sort of, you're sort of halving your market, or maybe even like it's a quarter of who has the time to do those sort of stories anymore. I'm not saying that we should abandon good journalism at all.
Well, you're privileging the likes of the ABC in this.
You are privileging the likes of the ABC. That's right. Who have still resources and time for that. But whereas companies who have commercial components, which most do, and are sort of still chasing those markets and need to you know, as we've seen, you know, sometimes make redundancies, you know, they just don't have those options of spending that sort of length of time. So it can't just be, you know, I went and did this for 6 months and I was able to do this massive investigation, because there's a lot of people who have the ability to do that just don't have the platform to do it on anymore.
So what did the Walkley say to you?
I can't remember. It was a while ago. I think they just sort of said that. I mean, it was a good conversation. They were actually talking about some of the awards. It was just a discussion about, you know, the awards, and, you know, I think they look at that regularly to see whether they need to change them or shift them, or, you know, do they have too many? Do they have too little? So I'd like to see more digital journalism recognition or awards that go beyond sort of like innovation. And it's like, well, that's great. We all know infographics are enormous. They're amazing. But it's not, but they're done by our product teams, and they deserve recognition too. But I guess I'm talking about, like, you know, who cracked it? Who did the best digital execution around, you know, a massive news event like Christchurch?
Yeah. Who did?
Probably news.com.au. I would say we did. I would say we did. I would say we did. It's like, you know, I the ABC obviously, you know, leads in politics most of the time, but we beat them in a month of a federal election. We hung on to our number one because we know what our readers like, and they came to us in the end for politics, and that might surprise people, but our readers are passionate about politics. They love it. They just need it brought to them in a way that they sort of get, like, why do I care about this again?
Well, that brings up a subject that we've talked a little bit about several times on this show, which is what springs out of the most recent digital news report, which is a global survey of consumer attitudes to news. The local part of that is done by the University of Canberra. It came out a couple of weeks ago, and it had some disturbing results, which, you know, go to exactly what you're just talking about. One was Australians are massive avoiders of news. Two, that interest in news is falling. And three, that many Australians think the news is too negative and not relevant to their lives. I mean, what do you think about that? You'd know how to fix that.
I haven't seen that. That's depressing.
65% of Australians are identified as news avoiders, which means not all the time, but occasionally, sometimes, or often.
I think they're liars. That can't be right. How can they say they're news avoiders? They can't avoid news because they're all on Facebook, so they're getting their news through Facebook, if nothing else.
Well, that's the point, that a lot of consumers think that if it's important, news will find them rather than it, you know, the other way around, which I think is actually quite true.
Yeah, yeah. And look, we have a lot more control over our news than we used to. People use apps, so they, you know, they either turn on their alerts or they don't. They certainly see their phone as their environment, so they're either looking at it through, you know, a news.com.au app, or they're looking at it through their Apple feed or another feed that they've set up. But they do, I think people like that area of control. So again, that's part of our job, is to make our content so compelling, or our currency so valuable, that people feel that it's important to them. We know that their time's limited. You can't just say, oh, you must read this massive long form. It's like, all right, maybe or maybe not. You know, how many things have I bookmarked that I'll never ever read? If only I had time. So look, I don't know. I'm not that depressed about it. I think that's probably, I hate to say poo poo to that survey, but
you can say poo-poo if you want.
Well, I don't see it. I think our numbers are going up. Obviously, we fight hard against some big competitors for our numbers, but I don't think people are tired of news. I don't think they're not going to the news. I think they're weary of it. I actually think that there's probably just a lot of news around, so that sort of, they get a bit overwhelmed.
Well, a final question on that. One of the things that came out, as I said, was that a lot of people find the news too negative. What do you think about that? Because, you know, you kind of mix it up quite a lot.
Yeah,
with news.com.
I think they tend to be drawn to negative stories, to be honest. I think that if I were to put a negative story and then a really positive story next to each other on a homepage, the negative story would probably be the one they would click on, which doesn't mean we don't run positive stories. We do them all the time. But, again, you can't just say this is really heartwarming, because they don't seem to care. So it is a sort of discrepancy in what they report and what they actually read. We mix it up. You don't want a whole homepage that's full of doom and gloom, but unfortunately there are some pretty awful things going on, and those are the things that people seem to be interested in finding out about.
And we shouldn't necessarily avoid them.
No, you can't
as
avoid
the
them.
News industry is our job.
You can have a good news section.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, on that note, I think we're going to leave this. So we could talk for another 2 hours.
We could talk forever.
Yeah.
Anthony's got to go home.
He's got to go home. He's going to feed the kids. Stop them getting them off their phones. Yes. Yeah. Kate DeBrito, Editor-in-Chief of news.com.au. I hope you see why 10 million Australians a month can't be wrong. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, we'll do it again sometime. Thanks, everyone, for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. And make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear it when you like, and you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a few things in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. And yes, thanks to Anthony, my producer, and my name is Peter Frey, and thank you very much for listening.